Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye, all persons having any business before this Honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii draw nigh. Give your attention and it shall be heard.
Please call the case.
Case number SCAP-17367. In the matter of the tax appeal of Priceline.com Incorporated versus Director of Taxation, State of Hawaii. Arguing for the taxpayers, appellees, cross-appellants, Paul Alston. Also appearing for the taxpayers, appellees, cross-appellants, Ronald I. Heller. Arguing for the appellant, cross-appellee, Gary Cristiani. Also appearing for the appellant, cross-appellee, Robert A. Marks and Kenneth T. Okamoto. Argument on the merits.
All right, good morning to all of our counsel. Mr. Alston and Mr. Cruciani, you both are ready to proceed today. All right, so we've allocated the time as follows. Mr. Alston, you'll begin. You'll be addressing both appeals for 25 minutes, followed by Mr. Cruciani addressing both appeals for 25 minutes, and then Mr. Alston, your rebuttal. We'll give you 10 minutes for rebuttal, and Mr. Cruciani, 10 minutes for your rebuttal. Please proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. As everyone in this courtroom, except perhaps my colleague from Texas, knows, every day we share our road with thousands of sunburned tourists on their way to Hiena, Haleiwa, Hawaii, or Hana in rental cars. We also know that at the airport it's hard to find space because the state is spending over $1 billion here and on Maui building rental car facilities for tourists. That context is important because, as Justice Pollack wrote in Travelocity several years ago, the legislature's purpose in adopting the splitting provision in sections 18F, 18G, and 18H was intended to protect the tourist industry in a variety of ways against the harm that is caused by pyramiding the general excise tax on services that are rendered directly to customers or tourists. And so the first question for you to decide today is fundamentally whether rental cars or rental transportation is part of or is a tourism-related service. The answer to that, I submit, is clearly yes. And if you agree with that proposition, then the subsidiary question of whether it is also transportation disappears. And I'll come back to that dichotomy. But the fact is that the list that's provided in 18F is clearly intended to be just illustrative and provide a few examples of the array of services that the tourism industry provides to people who visit Hawaii. And the director has historically taken that position. And we know that it's just illustrative and simply a few of the examples because, in fact, in a variety of tax information reports and letter rulings, I should say, the director has, in fact, said that things that aren't identified there are included.
Mr. Alston, you know, if you look at F, and there's a level of detail of everything that's mentioned, and then you also go outside of F and look at G and H, you have motor carriers, hotels, lay greetings, dinner cruises, canoe rides. I mean, many, many, many things that probably have an economic impact smaller than the rental car industry, yet the rental car industry is not mentioned explicitly. And the inference the director would draw from that is that omission is intentional. What's your response to that?
The response is two things. There are a lot of Latin maxims, and they're cited here back and forth. You can find them for almost anything. But there is no maxim and there is no rule of construction or law that says that the legislature has to list the big things instead of the obscure things. In fact, it is more important perhaps for the legislature to list obscure things to make sure that they're protected when the obvious things don't need to be mentioned. And when the legislature's purpose is to protect the industry, and when in 1991 the legislature is burdening the rental car industry with a variety of other taxes, the rental car tax, the daily rental car tax surcharge, and so forth, to suggest that the legislature also, by omitting the rental car industry in this description here, this expansive description with the catch-all, with the expansive catch-all, is simply to undermine the legislative purpose of protecting the industry.
Mr. Alston, is there a difference whether somebody makes a reservation through an OTC as opposed to directly talk to the rental car company?
Only in the sense that there is a different amount that would be taxable in the transaction. In this respect only. If they make it through directly through Hertz or Avis or what have you, then that entity pays 100%.
Right, okay. And maybe I phrased it wrong. Is there a difference if the person makes a tour package, hotel, air, and car, as opposed to just a car reservation through the OTC?
The way Judge Chang would have it, the answer is yes. The way Judge Chang would have it is if there is a package of tour activities, then there is splitting on the car rental. And you know, we have acknowledged and accept the idea that the OTC should pay on their share of the revenue that's derived. And so the same would be true if somebody coupled a car rental with a 10-cent tour of the Capitol in this building. Because it's a tour package, there would be splitting. If it's just a direct standalone car, it's the director's position, there's pyramiding. In our position, there should be splitting.
Mr. Alston, could I interrupt you for a sec and ask your clarification of your reliance on 237.18F with respect to the definition of tourism-related services? Because I understand your point that, you know, the car industry would seem to be part of tourism. But in terms of the parameters of your definition of tourism-related services, you rely on the language that speaks to services rendered directly to the customer.
Or tourist.
And it says customer or tourist, which would seem to support your argument that tourism-related services doesn't necessarily have to apply just to a tourist, right? It speaks to customer or tourist. So, in this case, is your point that when you have an OTS that's involved in selling to a customer or a tourist, whatever is sold is subject to the GET apportionment, or are you just focused on the nature of this particular activity, which is, you know, the rental car industry, if you follow me?
I understand what you're saying, and the answer is it's got to be a tourism-related service. The word customer in that context would seem to indicate that the legislature did not intend to have the provider grill every customer and say, are you a tourist or are you just a customer?
And in line with that, your position would be if it's a tourist-related service, but it's being provided to, say, a local person and not a tourist, then it would qualify.
In the director's briefs, there are arguments about whether if a Honolulu attorney travels to Maui and rents a car, is that a tourist-related service? They say no. I would say yes. Because I would consider that to be a business tourist activity or business, you know. But you know, I don't think at the margins there's a need to parse that. So the fact is that that both from the letter rulings issued by the department over the years, which expand on the adjectival words and phrases that are found in the statute, and from the declaration provided by former Director Kawafuchi that indicates that during his tenure at least, the department took the position that any service provided by a travel agent to a traveler was covered by 18F, you know, we come to the court with the reality that for years this was an accepted broad list of things. And when you look at the nature of rental cars, you have to conclude that it's a tourism-related service. This is not a situation where there is a stingy catch-all phrase at the end, a limiting catch-all phrase. This is one where there's a very broad catch-all phrase. And as I said, the fact that they chose to list...
What about their argument that all the 10 things that are listed are sort of ends unto themselves and... rental car is sort of a means to an end. And so it's different.
It may be for some people a means to an end, but in fact, I think the reality is that tourists sometimes rent cars, maybe often rent cars, just to travel around to see the beauty of Hawaii. That is an end in itself. They may not be headed in any particular destination. They just be doing a Circle Island tour. They may just be, you know, going from, you know, around East Maui, around West Maui, or around the Big Island to see the, you know, the beauty of the islands. That is an end in itself. And I think that again, when you have a variety of adjectives that the director has acknowledged are not exclusive, but are simply illustrative or simply some examples, you cannot say that something is that's not specifically listed as excluded, when in fact, by every rational analysis, it is a tourism-related service.
What about the director's argument that a lot of people rent cars who aren't tourists?
They do, and it may be that the department should direct the taxpayers to distinguish between tourists and non-tourists in that respect, but they haven't done that. And certainly that is within the power through rulemaking to say, wait a minute, you have to be sure that when you're splitting, that you're splitting for the benefit of tourists or people engaged in tourism activities.
If an attorney chose to go to an OTC to book a hotel, air, car package to go to the Near Island for a depot trip, there would still be splitting,
there would
correct?
Be. There would be.
And according
would be,
to your
and that would be business tourism. If any of us chose to vacation on the neighbor islands and get those things, there would be splitting. And the question is, you know, do you distinguish it when it's car only or not? And the answer is, it's still a tourism-related activity. The phrase transportation as part of a package is no different, really, than the phrase dinner cruise or canoe ride or catamaran cruise. They are all... That is simply an adjectival phrase that describes a type of activity, which is illustrative, nothing more. I mean, we know that the department allows splitting on not just dinner cruises, but sunset cruises and other types of cruises. We know that if it's a trimaran or a monohull cruise, they still get splitting. So when it's transportation in any form, there should be splitting.
Mr. Alston, the director argues that in 1991, when that catch-all provision we've been talking about was added, the legislature also added Chapter 251, which imposed surcharges for rental cars. And their argument is the language of that, the fact that that provision was added, which in effect is a tax burden on that industry, runs sort of contrary to your argument that the legislature was trying to protect the industry in subsection F. And the other thing they argue is that the language of Chapter 251 suggests there is a distinction between rental cars and transportation. Could you respond to those arguments?
Yes, I can. You know, it is true that in 1991 they added the rental car surcharge. The question is, did the legislature also intend to add a double burden by providing for pyramiding with respect to that? I submit the answer is no. If you look at the purpose of protecting the industry, it requires a great leap of faith to believe that the legislature intended not only to charge the industry $3 a day per car, but to double up by then allowing pyramiding when every other tourism-related activity was excluded.
Wasn't the legislature's purpose to remedy and address inequities in how these tourist services were being treated? I mean, that was one of the purposes that the legislature authorized income splitting of tourist-related services. So the argument has to be that despite rental car industry being one of the largest tourist-related industries, that the legislature passed a provision that had this inclusive clause that says all other and other services rendered directly to the customer, and they were excluding rental cars, and there's nothing in the legislative history that says anything about that? Is that the conclusion that we're supposed to draw?
What you should draw is that the legislature, remember, the history of this statute is in 1996, it was limited to just four activities, very narrow, very precise. And what happened is over the course of the next 5 years, the rest of the industry woke up, but the rest of the, you know, the people involved in other activities woke up and said, you need to expand it. And again, you know, you end up with a list that is a function of, you know, perhaps the effective lobbying by people who provide certain types of rides or cruises and that sort of thing. But the fact is that the legislature chose to list a few things, some obscure, some very obscure, and then say, and other any other tourism-related activity. Again,
but the point is, does that expansive clause supposed to include rental cars when nothing is said?
Yes, but is it supposed to include a variety of things as to which nothing is said? The answer is yes. There's no reason to think that the legislature had to make that page 11 items, 12 items, or 100 items long in order to have them covered when it included the catch-all, the broad catch-all. And that's the point. I mean, there's no rule of legislative drafting that says when the legislature starts making a list and includes a catch-all, it has to start with the big things and not the obscure things. It just has to, if the catch-all is broad, then everything within that catch-all is swept in. They certainly know how to draft a list that was exclusive. They did that in 1996.
But on the other hand, Mr. Alston, it sounds like you're conceding that simply because a service is being sold by an OTC doesn't qualify it as being a tourism-related service.
It may not.
Yeah. I mean, you refer to an part of the economy that is a common one that's associated with not just the travel industry, but you know, normal activities by citizens. For example, dinners. It refers to dinner shows. I mean, I don't know if it's necessary to speculate about it, but it's interesting to consider if arrangements were being made just for dinners.
Right, but in that respect, it exempts or allows splitting on admissions to extravaganzas and luaus and that sort of thing.
I thought extravaganzas was a wonderful term. I don't see it very often in statutes, I guess you don't necessarily have to define it for me, but it's enjoyable to think about what the extravaganzas are.
And that's why when you look at this list, you can see the legislature was focused on, you know, a variety of things, even the most obscure. I think any of us would be challenged to identify an extravaganza that people go to. But if local people go to Expedia or any other travel agent and say, could you book me a ticket to go to the Luau at Germain's or Paradise Cove, that would be subject to splitting because it's a tourism-related activity. Again, it promotes the industry, not the activities of any particular individual.
Mr. Alston, could you address the issue of whether the matters we're talking about today should have been addressed in the prior litigation? And I believe that's your claim preclusion argument. I think the state suggests that doctrines such as claim preclusion shouldn't be applied against the state in the tax context, that would undercut the sovereignty or the state's sovereign ability to tax. Could you address those arguments?
Yes. In the Hanohano case in 117 Hawaii, this court applied collateral estoppel to the state. In Price versus Magoon in 75 Hawaii, it applied res judicata to the state. In medical underwriters, it applied the rule that the state, like any other litigant, cannot avoid the consequences of failing to make arguments when it seeks reconsideration. It's stuck. And so there are, in fact, examples where the sovereign has been bound by preclusive rules, court-made preclusive rules.
Have you applied res judicata against the state in a tax case?
There is none. There is none in this state. There are the federal cases that we've cited. There are some other state
rules. But in the federal cases, aren't there statutes that specifically allow for example, those compulsory counterclaim cases? Aren't those situations where there's a statute allowing the federal government to file a counterclaim? They say may in those statutes.
Right, and the Hemmings case, which is cited by the director, pages 11 and 12 of its brief, is a case where the court said, as the director mentioned, what's good for the goose is not necessarily good for the gander. And in that case, the court said that a an assessment by the government is not a compulsory counterclaim. And therefore, the fact that an assessment wasn't made by the government does not preclude further litigation. But you only need to address the question about what is and isn't a compulsory counterclaim if at the threshold there is the prospect of applying res judicata to the tax controversy. And this is something that although in this case we're facing the second bite at the apple by the government, in fact, as the statement of related cases shows, we are facing the third bite at the apple by the government in the tax court right now. There are pending assessments and pending appeals relating not only to agency car transactions, but agency hotel transactions. And we came and litigated to a fairly well in the tax court and here the scope of the online travel company's liability for hotel transactions. The director made a considered choice. I'm going after the merchant model. I'm not going after the agency.
Suppose a person who made the considered choice, that was your example, made a mistake. Should the state sovereignty tax power be taken away because an employee makes a mistake?
But it's more than a mistake.
Well, my example is a mistake. Let's use the mistake and then let's use this case. I mean, are we going to have the power to tax, which is fundamentally one of the most important powers that the government has, which, you know, informs and creates and enables its existence, to be taken away because an employee makes a mistake or a lawyer makes a mistake on filing a claim or a case is dismissed? All of a sudden, it's eliminated because of that action.
Right. I would acknowledge that there are several limitations on the circumstances which would trigger res judicata. If the taxpayer has concealed its business activity, there should be no res judicata. If the tax director is legitimately in doubt about the scope of the activity and can't discover it, there shouldn't be res judicata. But when, as here, the record would reflect that the director was aware, the department was aware of the business activity.
Well, you point to one letter, right? And there's a dispute about this letter. So it comes back to the point, we could have huge financial consequences because an employee misapprises or someone makes an inadvertent error. That seems a really strong sanction.
And as again, there are circumstances in which it may not apply.
Under these circumstances, is my understanding correct that your clients actually did not file GET returns for these subject years?
They did not start filing GET returns until recently. That's correct, Your Honor.
So you did concede that if the potential tax liability was concealed, there should be no res judicata.
Right.
Isn't not filing tax returns concealment?
No. Not when the director, through his agents, demonstrates an awareness of the scope of that activity, not when anyone who went to the OTC's websites at any time in the last decade and a half could see that activity prominently featured. It's not a question where they're proceeding in the shadows. I acknowledge there was no return, but the business activity is being openly conducted, and they made a choice. And to Justice Pollack's point, it may be that the rule should be subject to some qualifications and limitations when the failure to file is the product of a mistake or something other than a considered decision. But here, we know that they made a considered decision because the activity was known, discussed, and so forth well before they moved for summary judgment and got summary judgment in the first case.
Could you help me with the record there, Mr. Alston? I may misunderstand it. I thought there was a position taken by the tax director that was based on an auditor's letter that said that the tax department wasn't aware of the issue pertaining to the GET apportionment until 2012.
There is a declaration by a department employee.
I mean, I think that the trial judge actually you could call it a finding, but made a point about how it would seem widely known that rental car business was taking place. But nonetheless, my question was, do you think the record is clear that there's not a factual issue there?
Well, I think it's clear based on the 2008 letter, which was authored apparently largely, if not entirely, by the litigation counsel for the department, that they were aware of that. It's also reflected in the 2010 filing and the, I'm sorry.
The letter, though, doesn't that talk about initiating an investigation? Does that talk about actually taxing the entities?
It talks about initiating an investigation and seeking information about business activity.
So do you think that as soon as someone in the tax department says something like that, they should start taxing right away before they do their investigation?
No. And Chapter 237, Section 39, allows the department the authority to investigate fully. It gives them subpoena power, the ability to demand information. And my proposition is not that they have to act immediately, because going back to Justice McKenna's point, because there was no return, there was no deadline. There was no statute of limitations. They can proceed whenever they are ready to proceed. And when they have the power to investigate, to subpoena, to force the disclosure of information, and they make a choice not to proceed, then they should be held to that choice. And when that choice is carried through, not only through the initial filing, but the amended filings. Remember, in this case, in the hotel case, what happened is there was a first round of assessments. We get into that case, and essentially they amended the assessments by adding more. And we ended up facing assessments totaling more than $1 billion because they were swinging for the fences. They could have, and they knew at that point that they had the information needed to assess also for rental cars, and they didn't do it. And so, you know, here we're faced with a situation, if I could just wrap up this portion, we're faced with a situation where in the hotel case we faced $1 billion and we ended up paying less than $50 million. Here, too, they're ignoring the history, they're ignoring the legislative purpose, and swinging for the fences in a way that can only cause harm to the tourist industry, by negatively impacting a very significant part of it. So I would ask you to rule for us on the interpretation. I would also ask you to say, if there's any doubt, remand for the purpose of resolving what they knew and when they knew it. But there is enough here to say that res judicata at some point must preclude repetitive litigation about the same tax for the same tax year for the same tax year.
It has to be the same claim.
It has to be the same tax. It has to be for the same general excise tax activity.
Same claim, but we'll discuss it on
the same. Right. And because that's what the federal cases teach. I mean, federal cases teach income tax is a separate claim from other types of tax.
Thank you very much, Mr. Olson. We'll hear now from Mr. Cruciani.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. I seized on the same point that Justice McKenna did. It is the very definition of concealment not to file your tax returns. And let's be clear. During the assessment period from 2000 through 2013, the OTC has generated over $500 million of gross receipts. They did not pay one penny of tax, and they never filed a tax return during that time period.
Does the statute allow the state to have multiple bites at the apple, though?
Or sure.
Does
it? Sure. There's. First off,
where does the statute say that?
Well, first off, res judicata is not statutory.
I understand that.
It is a judicial creation. As you pointed out, Justice Pollack, there is no Hawaii Supreme Court case that has ever applied res judicata against the government. Indeed, they cite in the entirety of jurisprudence of this country, they cite two cases in which res judicata has been applied against the government in the tax context. One federal case that is distinguishable on the facts, Erickson, and an Oregon tax court case where there they were seeking to tax the very same transaction for the very same years. So there is no precedent to support that. Moreover, the opinion that Justice Nakayama penned in Medical Underwriters, we think, is an exact analogy. In fact, there, for 15 years, the taxpayer, based upon what it believed was input from a state agency, did not pay taxes. They filed returns, but they didn't pay taxes based on what they were told. And this court said that doesn't matter, that there can be no estoppel against a government, against a sovereign state. The failure of the tax submission to attempt to collect taxes now sought to be collected for the plaintiff for a period of 15 years constitutes no defense. They had a better position. They were at least on the radar screen. Here, they flew completely under the radar screen.
So is there no limit on the government's ability to taxpayers characterize it in the brief, slice and dice the claims? Is there literally no limit? Could this be going on for years with multiple claims, multiple assessments, 5, 10 different assessments, all 10 of the things in the list, agency transactions, merchant transactions, or is there some limit at some point?
I think there's no legal limit. I think there's a practical limit. What the state has done is it went after the hotel merchant transactions. That was the Travelocity opinion. It went after, in this case, the merchant rental car transactions. And then there are the agency transactions. There are very different transactions. There are different laws that apply to each of those transactions. So it's not like the state is, you know, just trying to nibble away at this one at a time for no reason. There are good reasons for this. And in fact, the record is clear on the timing of when, of what we knew and when we knew it. But Susan Atherton says, as a corporate representative, in September 2012 was the first time the state had notice. Mr. Randall, who wrote the letter, it was drafted by Mr. Wolin, said when he retired in March of 2013, he had no knowledge that the OTCs were conducting these rental car transactions.
But no limit whatsoever on the government's power to proceed on multiple occasions against a single taxpayer? There's no limit. Even if, imagine, for example, this was an individual taxpayer, just multiple repeated assessments. There's no limit at all for the same year?
Well, I think the answer is there is not a legal limit. I think there is probably a practical limit. I don't know.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I think that the state could proceed as long as you're talking about different claims, different taxes. You can't relitigate the exact same claim for the exact same tax that you lost on. But what you're talking about is there a limit? We would say no on being able to litigate merchant hotel, merchant rental, agency trend.
You're saying the state could go back against the OTCs for the same hotel? Tax the same issues that were raised in the prior case?
No, I'm not saying
that. Right.
I think it's different when you actually litigate. We could not relitigate, for example, the hotel assessments that were actually litigated in this court.
And that's because collateral estoppel would apply, and no one's really addressed that issue in this case, but collateral estoppel would apply regardless of the res judicata issue.
That's right. So if we had litigated in the prior case whether or not Section F as opposed to Section G, which was the transient accommodations, applied, if that was an issue in this case, then you may have a collateral estoppel issue here. But you don't have a collateral estoppel in connection with the merchant car case.
And, Mr. Cruciani, isn't that the analysis that the trial judge relied upon, essentially that this is a different activity, it's not the hotel activity that was in Travelocity, but instead it's a different activity, the car?
Yes, Justice Wilson, that's exactly correct. It has to be the identical claim. That's what this court has said. The res judicata test is this. The claim decided in the original suit is identical with the one presented in this case. And again, merchant hotel, merchant rental, different facts, different transactions, different law. There's no identity. And the court further says that how we define identical is the transaction test in Hawaii, which is it must arise out of the same transactions or series of connected transactions. Again, transactions there were hotels, transactions here are car rentals.
Is there a factual dispute as to when the OTCs started including rental cars in their packages or their offerings?
That wasn't addressed per se in the briefing, but you know, some of the OTCs, for example, do almost all standalone transactions. That would be Priceline and Hotwire, almost 100%. This is in Mr. Silva's declaration. He's the economist from Econ 1 who lays this all out. Others, like Expedia and Orbitz, do almost all package transactions.
Okay, my point is, it seems like when I go online and look at OTCs, those car rental things have been up there a long time. I don't quite understand why the tax department only knew about it in 2012.
Well, if the question is, does the tax department have the duty to go search for taxpayers who don't file returns, go search their websites to see what they're offering, I would submit that's not their duty. Would there be folks within the tax department who may actually have booked a car rental through the OTC? I think that's certainly possible, no evidence in the record, but that doesn't, I think that's just a bridge too far to say if somebody has generic knowledge that an OTC has rental car transactions, that triggers an obligation on the state to assess rental car transactions at pain of, even if it's a mistake, at pain of foregoing that claim forever.
You know, one of your arguments against construing rental cars as transportation and travel, tourist-related activity, is that local people rent cars, non-tourists rent cars, I should
yes.
say. But don't non-tourists also rent hotel rooms?
Sure. And you have a transient accommodations tax that this court dealt with in Travelocity that addressed that. If they only had it here, if they only had rental cars written into subparagraph F, we wouldn't have an issue. And I thought Justice Wilson's comment was insightful on the extravaganzas. It strikes me as illogical in the extreme.
But what does "and other services rendered directly to the customer" mean? I mean, why put in a clause like that unless you're making it broadly encompassing?
Because there is a century of jurisprudence that this court has developed, primarily the Husum Generis case law, that addresses, from a statutory interpretation context, how you deal with that. If you would have asked me, for example, with respect to the case that has the diver's knife, whether that is an other deadly or dangerous weapon, it's described as a 6.5-inch serrated knife. That statute specifically includes a dirk, stabbing, and dagger as part of the enumerated items. Yet this court said that knife is of a different kind or character, and importantly, the court said we should not act by judicial fiat in writing into the statute that unenumerated item. Rather, what we should do is defer to the legislature.
Aren't criminal statutes, by not only history but by practice, narrowly construed? We're not in the same sort of context, especially when we have legislative history that says, look, we're trying to address inequities.
I agree with you, but if you read all those cases, because that's a lot of the Husum Generis cases talk about that other deadly or dangerous weapon statute, they're applying the same rule you apply in a civil statute, the Husum Generis rule.
But doesn't that rule also say if the general rule words are given their full and natural meaning, they would include the objects designated by the specific words, making the latter superfluous? So are we making, does the last clause in the statute make all the other terms superfluous?
I think that's a great point. And because what happened in 1991, and I think it's significant, you had in 1986 four enumerated items. There's no question under the tourism-related services that rental cars were not included. So for 5 years, notwithstanding the supposed significance of the rental car industry and the legislature's desire to protect it, they didn't protect rental cars, undisputably, for 5 years. So I think it's significant, Justice Pollack, whenever they amended the statute in 1991, they just didn't say, we're going to keep these four and add a residual clause. Rather, they added luaus and lay greetings and other classic tourism-related services, which I think, I would submit, expresses the legislative intent for a narrow construction of what tourism-related services are. They just didn't do a global and say, as long as it's a service directly provided, it's in. Nor do the OTCs make that argument. It has to be a tourism-related service.
Even if it's, we construe it as narrow, just by the phrase of having other services rendered directly to the customer or tourist and construe it narrowly, how does rental cars not fit in there?
Again, because it has to be of a similar nature, of the same class or character. That is the 100-year case law history.
So air transportation is similar to leg greetings?
No, air transportation is not even subject to tax.
But it says, but only if the providers of the services other than air transportation are subject to, I see.
Yeah, this comes under federal preemption.
Okay.
Yes, right. So, but also, yes.
Well, I don't quite get why it's not of a similar nature. Because canoe rides, dinner shows are not exactly similar. So I don't think it, even if we construe it narrowly, it's not enumerated narrowly.
What is, and I actually like their colloquial phrase of similar nature, what's the tie that binds?
Okay, what is the tie? You folks argue that it has an activity is something that people primarily do for enjoyment or recreation. That was the story.
Yes,
so people don't rent cars for enjoyment?
Sometimes they do, but it is not that, in the recourse for that type of product, that type of service, is you specifically write it into the statute. These folks know how to lobby the legislature. They know how to go in and get relief and say, we want to remove any ambiguity, let's put rental cars into the statute. But they
A minute, that's a legislative principle. I'm not very familiar with that. If you write a broadly encompassing clause that there's some requirement that you specify or enumerate the item. I mean, if you write a clause that encompasses it on its face, why would you need to do that? Why, if you're a rental car company, you read this and it says, and other services rendered directly to the customer. Well, that's us. That's what we do. Why would you run to the legislature and say, hey, put that in, even though you're not excluded in the legislative testimony?
Because there's, I would submit, an obvious difference between something that is expressly enumerated. If you're in the leg reading business, you don't need to worry about splitting. You're covered. But if you're in the rental car business, then you're subject to the interpretation, well, is this residual clause cover it? And I would argue the opposite of my colleague. The more significant the industry, the more you would make certain to include rental cars. If you're going to talk about extravaganzas, surely you're going to make clear that rental cars are covered.
You folks are, excuse me.
That's okay, go ahead. What do you mean by significant? More significant the activity. Do you mean the more it brings in dollar revenue? Because I don't know how significant canoe rides and leg readings could possibly be. Why would they be more significant?
Well, I'm suggesting to you, and again, we don't have dollar amounts in the record, but I don't know if we can take judicial notice or not, but it would strike me certainly as the hotel industry is obviously hugely significant. And the legislature saw fit in 1987 to give them an express income split. And with respect to tourism-related services, the classic tourism-related services, the legislature saw fit in 87 and did in 91 to address that. Why wouldn't they address rental cars? And why would there not be one word, to your point, Justice Pollack, not one word in the legislative history, in a committee report, in a TIR, like TIR 91-8, not one word that mentions rent.
Well, what's the purpose of all this? What is the purpose of 237.18F? Isn't it to prevent pyramiding? Isn't it to make sure that our tourism industry remains competitive?
It is exactly to protect those categories that fall within it expressly. It is absolutely.
So, in other words, if now the OTC start to include a bike rental or a moped rental within the packages that are offered, there's no splitting available for that. In other words, 237, under your definition, 237.18F you know what? They'd have to pay the entire GET on the bike or moped rental portion, and then the moped and bike rental company would also have to pay the entire GET for that.
The answer is it depends on whether it is a tour package or a package. And if it's in this court, in deciding the TAT case, spent 8 pages discussing the word actual in the context of actual furnishing, which is the operative definition. And this court made a point of saying we must give effect to every word. There is zero evidence.
But here the word is "and other services rendered directly to the customer." What you're asking us to do is, despite the expansive language, try to interpret what was in the legislature's head based on neither mentioning or excluding rental cars. Either way, you're having us guess and bypass this language, which is expansive on its face and was passed explicitly, as Justice McKenna said, to stop pyramiding and protect the tourist-related services.
If it falls within the definition of tourism-related services, absolutely it was intended to stop pyramiding. But that, of course, begs the question. And it's interesting that the OTCs have never sought a letter ruling from the department. We've, in the record, each side cites the fact that, and we've never contended this is a exclusive list. So scuba diving, jet ski rentals are specific, classic tourism-related services that the director has said this qualifies for splitting. Why did these folks never write to the department?
If jet ski rentals qualify, why do car rentals not? It's not jet ski. I don't see jet ski rentals included in here.
And it's not. And that's our point. We're not saying that this is a dead letter. We're not saying that there was no effort to add flexibility beyond the 10 enumerated items. We acknowledge that. And again, we suggest the tie that binds are these classic tourism-related activities that are done for enjoyment primarily. And that's why a jet ski, that is what distinguishes, I would submit.
So how do you counteract the argument that driving in scenic areas is not for enjoyment?
Again, I don't take issue with that.
I mean, the Hana Road is perhaps one of the most famous drives in the world, and you're telling us that that is not for enjoyment? I mean, you're asking us to make these interpretations and conclusions that are outside the precise language that the legislature, and when they did it, they knew they weren't getting any everything, and they specifically, actually, if this is read closely, they actually narrowed the expansive category to other services when rendered directly to the customer services. That language did not apply to the other enumerated items. So not only did they give an expansive category, but they also narrowed it at the same time so it wouldn't apply to indirect delivery.
I would agree with you that if you take a rental car, do the road to Hana or some other scenic tour, that in that case, you know, you are using it for enjoyment. I wouldn't quibble with that point, but that's why you need to, the recourse is to have rental cars, which oftentimes have nothing to do with it. If I came down here and booked on Expedia to rent a car from the airport to come and argue this case, what does that have to do with tourism? How is that a tourism-related service? It has nothing to do with it. And the evidence, and this is Mr. Silva, the evidence is 2/3 of all the transactions are standalone transactions where the only rental is a car rental. So how many of those are me coming to the courthouse versus somebody going the road to Hana? The point is, you don't know, but it's their burden to show that by coming up here to argue this case and renting a car would be covered. It's their burden.
But, you know, so then please explain to me, why did the legislature include the word customer in tourism-related services? It seems to me it's pretty clear that they wanted to make sure that tourism-related services not only apply to these types of services provided to tourists, but also to customers.
Agreed. So if a customer, I kind of interpret customers being a non-tourist or perhaps a Hawaii resident. I don't know if that's the proper interpretation or not. But as we said in our briefs, it is the nature of the service. So whether you are a Hawaii tourist or a Hawaii native, and if you purchase a tour package that involves, you know, a lei greeting, a luau, a canoe ride, you are covered. On the other hand, if it is something that is outside the coverage of the tourism-related services, we would submit rental cars. It does not matter whether you are a tourist or a customer or a Hawaii native. It is the nature of the transaction that controls. In fact, I don't even think we have a dispute on that point. But again, I think that it's on the tour packager issue, they try to have it both ways. They try to hedge their bets. They try to say the other services covers both standalone and package car rental transactions. And in addition to that, transportation included in a tour package covers rental car package transactions. You can't have it both ways. You can't have it be both an enumerated item, at least as to package transactions, and swept in within the residual clause. We are consistent. I don't know if we're consistently wrong or not, but we're consistent. And that is that we say it is outside the scope of subparagraph F. It's not transportation. We haven't talked about that. If you look at all the examples of what transportation is, in each and every example, it's somebody driving you. It's the two examples in TIR 91-8, the pineapple cannery tour combined with the visit to the Arizona Memorial, where you're having a tour bus or a bus take you. And again, think it's significant that in 1991, when you have the same legislature dealing with taxation of rental cars, it's on their mind. Well, they could pass a...
I think Justice Wilson has a question. So.
Sorry, excuse me.
Thanks. I'm sorry to interrupt you, Mr. Cruciani, but you are enumerating now, I guess, what was anticipated by the legislature in the language. And I wanted your help because I've been waiting for you to explain what actually is included in the catch-all provision. Clearly, you don't think rental cars are, but obviously you agree that the enumerated categories aren't exclusive. So what would be included in the phrase that says other services?
I'm sorry, what would be included?
Yes.
Again,
I know you're defining it in terms of whether the service provides enjoyment, but I haven't heard you suggest what kind of activity might be included.
Two that I believe I mentioned were scuba diving and jet ski rentals. Those are specific examples, Justice Wilson, where there was a taxpayer letter request, and the department said, yes, these are included. Again, the very step that these folks could have taken, I submit they knew they weren't going to get an answer that they would have liked, and that's why they didn't submit it. And we know from the Travelocity case, there were numerous examples.
Now, this is a jet ski rental, right?
Yes.
Not necessarily part of a package.
Correct.
And it could be in the catch-all phrase.
Yes.
But it's different than a car rental because it's more often used by tourists? Is that
Again, it is for enjoyment. What is the tie that binds? The jet ski rental, I would submit, is much closer to what you do. You show up at the concierge desk. You say, hey, what tourist activities do you have available for me?
Yeah. For enjoyment, educational facilities are included.
Right.
Do you think that some of the children that, you know, have to go to the educational facilities actually enjoy it?
Well, I think that is, you know, a bit, perhaps a little bit more expansive than just pure enjoyment. But that is not a business activity. That is not a functional activity in the same way that a rental car is to take you from point A to point B.
So now you're using business.
This is Hawaii, and when people get in a rental car, they do it for a reason. And I would say the reason would be because we live in this beautiful location and it's quite enjoyable to drive around it. Because they don't need to, if they're in Waikiki, they don't have to. But the bottom line, I don't think the legislature wanted us trying to extrapolate what's enjoyable, what we think is enjoyable. That's not our function. Our function is to interpret what other services, when rendered directly to the customer or tourist, mean. And that would certainly seem to be rental cars.
And I would suggest, Your Honor, that is exactly your function. I don't disagree with that. But again, as this court said, rather than by judicial fiat writing in rental cars, where for since 1991 through the present, there's not one word ever that the legislature said we intended rental cars to be there.
And isn't there an affidavit that says that's that you folks have been, is that affidavit incorrect?
I'm sorry, I don't know what
I thought that former tax director submitted an affidavit saying that that's how they treated rental cars.
No, that is a misrepresentation of what Director Calafucci said. Director, and they ellipses out the relevant portion, which is Director Calafucci says, we never addressed this issue. And Ms. Addison says, there has never, this is a case of first impression. There has never been an audit. There has never been a letter ruling. There has never been a prior instance through a rule or promulgation of PIR where the legislature or the department has addressed this.
If this case dealt with jet ski rentals, mm-hmm. that was the issue before us,
yes.
would it have been judicial fiat for this court to construe other tourism-related services, jet ski rentals, to be included within the phrase?
There you have a taxpayer letter that is binding on the director, so it would not be, because there's no dispute.
So only if there's a letter. If there's no letter for this court to interpret a statute as judicial fiat?
No, I would not submit that. So let me just change the hypothetical and say there was no letter for jet ski. So there's no letter, so now your job is, does jet ski fit within the residual clause? That's, of course, the court's job to determine whether that is or it's not. But what they've done is they have noticeably avoided any discussion of the 100 years of precedence on what I think is critically important, the Houston Generis case law here, where invariably it is very narrowly construed. It's a narrow construction. That's where the judicial fiat language comes in, where we're going to construe this narrowly, and if the legislature wants to include nunchucks as an other dangerous deadly weapon, they didn't see fit to do that. If they want to include that, they can include it.
But wait a minute. If there wasn't a letter on jet ski, but you're conceding jet ski is a tourist-related industry.
Yes.
Okay. So there's no letter. So you're saying that if there's no letter and it's not included, that it doesn't get relieved of the tax burden?
No, I might have misspoke if that's...
Well, of course you didn't say that, because that doesn't make sense. So because it's not... if it's not included and there's no letter, then it would apply to other services rendered directly, right? And so jet skis would get the...
Jet skis, even if there was no letter.
Okay, so it's not included, there's no letter. Why aren't rental cars like that then?
Again, I would have to go back to the point that rental cars are, I think, of a fundamentally different nature. While there may be certain times where you're using your rental car for sightseeing or whatever, many times, again, two-thirds of these are standalone transactions. They're not part of any package.
But why does standalone make a difference? I'm not sure why it makes a difference. Are we supposed to judicially notice that when they're standalone, people aren't doing it for enjoyment, but if they do it, it's part of a package, they are?
No.
This is where the argument that you're giving us leads us.
Well, what if you're a Hawaii resident and your car's in the repair shop and you call the OTC and you rent a car through the OTC, they would say that's a tourism-related service?
Well, I'll tell you, I think that's a very strong argument, except for what Justice McKenna pointed out. The statute includes tourist or customer. There must have been a reason for that.
And
as a practical matter, we would just call them directly and get the kama'aina rate.
My butt's been up, so I may reserve.
Let's hear from Mr. Alston. Thank you very much, Mr. Cruciani.
Let me pick up a point that you mentioned very briefly, Justice Pollack, and that is Section 237-38 does talk about the assessment and in the singular, and it could be read to say that the department gets one crack at it, and one crack for a particular tax, for a particular tax year, for the particular the taxpayer. And although Mr. Cruciani would have you believe that this involves entirely different transactions than we were here about in 2015. In fact, in 2015, we were dealing with, among other things, merchant model hotel and car packages. And they dealt with the same transactions. And when the legislature applied splitting, it did on transient accommodations, it did so for tourists as well as business travelers, people who are on business tourism as well. And so there is splitting for, and the same is true with respect to local people who are in transient accommodations. They get the benefit of splitting. And so there is not the kind of bright line that he wants to make, and there's certainly no line that says if it's fun, it's split, and if it's not fun, it's pyramided. There's no basis for that.
But isn't our statute more directed for transaction-based for excise tax rather than either an annual or monthly sort of?
I'm sorry, Justice Pollack, I couldn't hear you.
Well, if we're looking at the same claim,
right.
When we're looking at income tax, it's income tax for a full year. When right. We're looking at excise tax, doesn't the excise, isn't it owed when it accrues? Isn't that what the statute says?
It is, and then the return is the return that's controlling is the reconciliation return at the end of the year. The
right,
monthly and quarterly returns
it's due,
are informational.
It's due when it accrues, right?
Correct. The tax is paid when it accrues, and that can be monthly, quarterly, or annual?
Well, when it accrues could be as soon as it's billed. I mean, if you take a look at some of the other subsections in the statute, for example, there's even 237.18, there's even different rates that are given in those various subsections.
Right. But the fact is that it's a unitary tax, regardless of the varieties of activities that a taxpayer is engaged in, at the end of the tax year, there is a return and a certain amount of GET owed on whatever taxes, whatever activities performed. And going to the question of what was known or knowable about the online travel company's activities, Judge Chang did find that, as Justice Wilson noted, the whole world knew that they were engaged in these sorts of activities. And if you look at something called the Wayback Machine on the internet, you can go back and look at the internet. You can look at the websites of the travel companies back into the 1990s and see what kind of business activities they were engaged in. It's really quite easy to find. And to Justice Pollack's point about the mistake, if there was a mistake and the assessment when it was first made was not all-inclusive, the department has many, many opportunities up to the point of final judgment to expand and build upon what it first assesses. But when the matter reaches a final judgment, the door needs to be shut on that, because we are now back again for the third time in the tax court facing liabilities for the same sorts of business activities that we've had with both the round and the first assessments and this assessment as well. Let me finally close by discussing briefly the medical underwriters case. Justice Nakao, you did write that except in cases of manifest injustice, equitable estoppel cannot be invoked against the government. But res judicata is different. No one has ever suggested that res judicata applies only when a litigant comes in and proves manifest injustice. In fact, the opposite is true. Res judicata applies except in the most rare instances where the person who would be barred by res judicata proves some manifest injustice, which provides the loophole that Justice Pollack, the exception that Justice Pollack might want to make for, might see as appropriate for the government.
Well, I'm not, you're trying to narrow the exception. I'm very concerned that res judicata is not going to apply when we're talking about sovereign tax power.
Well, but at some point, Your Honor, it has to be that a taxpayer is not subject to death by a thousand cuts.
Well, that's what collateral estoppel is for, I think. And that's a different issue than what we're facing, because collateral estoppel will protect the taxpayer.
Right. But res judicata should protect the taxpayer as well when a particular tax in a particular year has been litigated to a conclusion. And where
the claim is identical. I have two concerns, both with applying it against the sovereignty and calling this the same claim when our statute seems to say that the amount is owing when it accrues.
But again, in the hotel case, in the merchant hotel case, we were dealing not only with standalone hotel transactions, but also package transactions.
Well, if you can prove they're identical transactions, but according to the record, I don't think you folks have done that.
We did not attempt to parse the identity of the transactions because of the threshold proposition which we adopt, that you look at the tax activity, whether it's covered by the same tax scheme, not whether it involves.
So basically, according to your argument, if the state tax department sees a state tax return, income tax return, and lists, for example, rental property income, and also lists income for services rendered.
Yes.
And then realizes that there was no GET tax return filed. If they go after the rental income GET, they are then precluded from later going after the services rendered GET. That's basically your argument.
It is all the GET liability constitutes a single claim in our mind. And again, with the exceptions that if the activity is legitimately not discovered, then they can come back again. Because if it's been concealed from the department after due inquiry, right?
Suppose you guys, some of the OTCs started renting mopeds.
Right.
And it's not very many,
right,
but they start growing. Mopeds become the way to, you know, the kids want to do this. Are you saying that when it comes to the attention of the, because it's not widely known, that the tax director can't go back and say, hey, this is a non-covered, not a service rendered directly to, not a tourism related. Mm-hmm. They can't go back.
No, I don't think we need to get to the outer limits of the doctrine that we're trying to have you adopt. But I would acknowledge that if the director can say, wait a minute, that wasn't known or knowable, then they can come back. Absolutely, they can come back. But
you're not hiding anything.
No, right.
They're not sitting on their hands, not investing.
Right. But if they're sitting on their hands and we're not hiding it, then at some point they have to be stopped from coming back again for yet another bite at the apple. I think the let me just wrap up. I think that the proposition that the director espouses, that the organizing principle in 237.18F is fun or pleasure or enjoyment, simply falls apart, not only because this court should not be the arbiter of what's fun and not fun, but because the legislature didn't intend to have fun be the criterion. 1991 was the first Gulf War. It was the collapse of the Japanese bubble economy. There was all sorts of terrible things going on, inflicting Hawaii right then. And what they intended to do was to protect the industry. And you can't protect the industry without protecting the rental car aspect of the tourism activity.
Thank you very much, Mr. Olson. Mr. Cusiani, your rebuttal.
How many minutes I have left?
How much time?
Five. I don't know what their organizing principle is. At least we've suggested one. In response to Justice Wilson's question, they said not every activity or service that the OTCs provide would be covered. How do we know? How do we know? They've not suggested, even if it's a service directly provided in the tracks language, how do we know whether it's in or out? What is their organizing principle they select?
Well, what if they provide transportation services on the mainland for people to get to the airport? Would that be covered by the Hawaii GET?
By the income splitting provision?
Would that be subject to Hawaii GET if their package included transportation services on the mainland to the airport that the tourist is coming from?
I have to think about that when I haven't thought about, you know, what the effect of doing something on the mainland, you know, but so I don't know. I don't have a ready answer for you.
Mr. Cusiani, could you address the legislative history? I think Mr. Olson referred, you know, alluded to it at the end of his comments. If you go back and look at the history of 237.18, you know, back in 86, a discussion of serving the interests of the state and encouraging tourism. In 91, inequities, as Justice Pollack has referred to in the assessment of GET on travel-related companies. How is the position you're taking here consistent with that legislative history, or how could we reconcile it with that legislative history?
Because it begs the question as to what is encompassed within that. We know under subsection G, hotels are expressly provided.
We know there's at least 10 items under tourism-related services that are provided.
But if we found that to be ambiguous and we go to the legislative history, please address the legislative history.
Okay. There is no legislative history that talks about rental cars. So it's proving a negative. It is the absence of. And again, I think that's highly important because everybody knows that the rental car industry is a significant industry here. So the fact that there's not one word from one senator or one representative or one committee member mentioning rental cars, I would suggest to you, Chief Justice, is the relevance of the legislative history. And by the way, we always hear the sort of tourism Armageddon argument. Mr. Alston said, you know, in the hotels case, it was $1 billion at issue, and this would be crippling to these folks. It's $30 million. If you give us the relief that we're asking for and tax gross receipts on everything, it's probably $50 million. And when you think about it, it's $500 million in gross revenues over 14 years.
You know, counsel, we don't look at the amount of money to determine how we're going to interpret the statute.
It was an argument. I understand. It was an argument that's been addressed in this case.
Okay. I
think you said something like, you know, you, when you stood up, you said you don't know what that commonality is. You know, you've suggested. And I think one of the things that strikes me is that there's been so much argument on this doctrine, a jus de generis, and it's almost an assumption that doctrine is always applied. And there's several reasons why that doctrine is not applied if you look through the cases. First of all, as I noted, it generally applies when the final clause encompasses all the preceding words. So it would sort of make it surplusage or duplicate. We don't have that in this case. And also, the canon is not applied when it does not best harmonize with the design of the statute. And the design of this statute was to rectify inequities. So again, we don't necessarily have to apply that principle, and we also don't have to apply that principle when it doesn't seem to be consistent with the legislative history. Those are cases in our jurisdictions that have said that. So I think the fact that there is so much ambiguity as to a commonality indicates that is not an appropriate governing principle in this case.
Your Honor, again, I would just suggest that there is no legislative history to support rental cars. Yes, the specific tourism-related services that are identified, for sure, but we can't draw any conclusions from the other services.
It's used when there's ambiguity in language. The language on its face doesn't appear to be ambiguous when it says and other services rendered directly to the customer.
Mr. Alston would beg to differ based on what he said, which is there are other services rendered directly to the customer in response to Justice Wilson's question that would not be covered. So they're reading it at least differently than you
well,
are.
Well, that clause, of course, is subject to the income splitting and the travel agent. There's at least three express requirements, actually four, I see, to come within that income, to come within that clause on his face.
I see my comment.
If you'd like to wrap up very briefly.
Yeah, very briefly. So no evidence that transportation equals rental cars, no evidence that any of these transactions are tour package, and the word tour must be given significance. So we're left with the residual clause. For all the reasons we've suggested, there is no evidence, no suggestion that the legislature ever intended to include a silent tax break, a multi-million-dollar tax break to the rental car industry. And it just defies logic to suggest that if that was the legislative intent, we would not have heard one word from the legislature.
I'm sorry, rental car industry?
The rental cars, what we're talking about here.
I thought we were talking about the OTC industry here.
Yeah, it's, in other words, there's no evidence to suggest that the catch-all clause would apply to the rental car transactions that the OTCs facilitate.
Very well. Thank you so much to both of our lawyers here today. The court will take this matter under advisement.